This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng, and today on The Breakfast Grill is Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman, Minister of Youth and Sports. He's also a Member of Parliament for Muar and Youth Chief of Parti Pribumi Bersatu Malaysia. Syed Saddiq, good morning and welcome to the show. All right, you have asked for a few things pre-budget, 6 billion ringgit to create 350,000 youth jobs. In fact, you were given more, 6.5 billion, and 100 ringgit monthly allowance for TVET trainees and apprentices, and also the increase in minimum wage of to 1,200 ringgit per month from 1,100 currently. All these were fulfilled. I mean, you asked for it pre-budget, but this was fulfilled, and yes, you declared that this is a youth budget. So it sounds like the finance ministry listened to you, to the letter. Why is this the case? Do you think that this is a case of some very serious issues among the youth?
It is very serious. I told the Minister of Finance and the Prime Minister, it would be futile if we win 100 Olympic gold medals, but there are hundreds of thousands of young Malaysians who are unemployed. In the end, what's the value of a gold medal to those who are unemployed and who can't sustain him or herself and the family? So I think in the end, the priority for young issues is the politics of the stomach, right? It's about jobs. It's about the wage which they get. It's about affordable housing. And these are issues which should be given a great priority. And I'm privileged to have an attentive Prime Minister and a great Minister of Finance to listen to the concerns of young people. And I believe they themselves know, especially after the constitutional amendment which reduced the voting age to 18 years old, the youth will become the frontliners in deciding whoever governs in Putrajaya. So no one can ever silence their voices anymore.
And do you think that you personally have a direct line to the Prime Minister as well as the Finance Minister that they'll listen to your proposals?
They are very attentive. Not all will be accepted. And we have rigorous debates and dialogues. So we go front, back and centre. But the point is they listen. And that matters a lot.
Now, under the recent budget, the government launched the Malaysians at Work initiative to create a lot of employment opportunity. Under this, there is the Graduates at Work program, where the government is giving 500 ringgit per month for 2 years to hire graduates who have been unemployed for more than 12 months.
Yes.
And at the same time, also, the employers will receive a 300 ringgit monthly incentive. Yep. Do you think this will resolve the country's high graduate unemployment?
It will not automatically resolve, but it will definitely reduce. We have about 500,000 people who are unemployed, and about 140,000 to 160,000 of them are those who are skilled with diploma and degrees and beyond that. And we often hear cases where those who graduate from public universities, in the end, when they enter the job market, they can't get into the formal economy, and therefore they're forced to work either for Grab or for Grab Food, which is a problem, right? Because in the end, they are qualified. So how do we best incentivize the private sector to open up new jobs? I believe the best way is to give this kind of income incentive and to give another unique incentive for employees to hire more. Singapore has done it. You see how Dyson came in to Singapore. There was also income incentive given to their TVET graduates over there. You look at a lot of developed countries to stimulate the economy, especially during hard times, there must be a job stimulus and you must work well hand in hand with the private sector. In the 1980s, the government did something like this, right? In 1987, not during the 97 financial crisis, but back then, the biggest job creators were the government, was the government. So back then, it was done by the government. Also, now, when we are very much private-driven and there's private wealth which drives Malaysia forward, we need to incentivize private sector to open up new jobs. I believe this is one of the best ways to do so, which in the end, now, if you're an SME, you only hire 5 people. Now, you're even incentivized to hire 5 people more because the plan, if you look at what EPF presented, reduced the cost of employment by 20%. And I think this is great. At the same time, it gives that young person a 2 years quality working experience, hands-on, in that company. And what has been proven in many other countries, after that 2 years period ends, the retention rate is at a great 90%, which means that more young people will get jobs, experience jobs, quality jobs, which in the end will propel Malaysia forward, especially when we hit that economic recovery in about 2 to 3 years' time.
So this retention rate of 90% that you quoted is quite interesting, because I'm just trying to see what your end game, if you can envisage that, would be after 2 years, right? Because this only lasts for 2 years.
Yep.
And currently there are problems and reasons why these graduates at the moment are unemployable right now. The same reasons would also exist 2 years later. And worse still, at the end of 2 years, the graduates, you know, on the one hand, you have them being hired for 2 years, and on the other hand, it might create a dependence.
Yeah.
So where do you see the end game going?
Many studies have shown, if you look at KRI, Kazana Research Institute, it's not that our youths are incapable. Usually once they get into the door, they can prove themselves, and they can prove themselves much better than the rest. The question is to get them into the door. And the more we allow them to be unemployed, for example, after 12 months, they're still unemployed. They lose their skill sets. They become less employable in the long run. That's structural unemployment, and we don't want to reach there. So it's much better to integrate them into the company. And in that 2 years' time, they'll get valuable experience. They'll also be given the opportunity to prove themselves to the employers.
But why are they not being hired today? I mean, is it as simple as throwing money at the problem?
It's not that easy, but obviously when the market now is going through its own challenges, some are shrinking, some have stagnated in terms of employment opportunities, we need to stimulate it. You see, FDR did that in the 1930s. There's a big job stimulus. As I mentioned, Malaysia did it in the 1980s. Now is the time for you to stimulate the economy and ensure that not more jobs are created by incentivizing the private sector. And again, comes the critical question, what will happen after 2 years? If you are an employer and if you hired a person and that person has worked for you for 2 years, you will be able to assess that person's professionalism, work ethics. At the same time, you have already invested 2 years to train this person. There's a great likelihood that you're more likely to retain a person who has worked for you for 2 years, skilled by you, and has already been well experienced to work in that particular department. Therefore, the retention rate will be much higher. That's why this particular program differs greatly to SLIM, right? Which is more like an internship. You're not given full employment. On top of that, you're not given a full breadth of work like a full employee through this program. So I think this is a great investment for the government and for private sector as well to train this person in 2 years' time. This person, I firmly believe, if he proves himself, will be retained in that company and therefore have a great 2 years working experience in a great company.
This morning, we have Syed Saddiq, Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister, on the Breakfast Grill. And if you have any comments or questions, you can tweet or WhatsApp us. Now, Syed, the money, the 500 ringgit monthly, goes directly into EPF, and the MTUC has commented that this is a problem because it doesn't help people face the cost of living.
I think that's the part where there's a slight misunderstanding. So what I've been made to understand, there are two types of funds. There's obviously the EPF fund, which is for their savings. That will be predominantly for the 300 ringgit stimulus for the company. So company doesn't need to pay that money. It goes straight to the EPF savings. But the 500 ringgit will go to a special EPF account, which can be spent, which can be redrawn and spent there and there. So I take the criticism by MTUC, and they are spot on. They're spot on if that money cannot be redrawn there and there and spent by the employee, but it can. So this is...
Right, but it goes through the EPF, right?
Yes,
so
exactly.
it's a very roundabout way of giving them money. Why is this route being chosen?
I think in the end, it's just to ensure that the money reaches the hands of the people and we can track, and we can also get usable information for the future to know how we can improve the system better. But I think the end goal, which is to get the money to the person, will still be met.
So is it correct to say that the 300 ringgit also goes to the employees? You're giving the 300 ringgit to the employers who will put it into the EPF fund?
So that one is discretionary, but in the end, it's more to stimulate the private sector to take them in. But again, it's not just the 300 ringgit. If you look even at the income incentive of 500 ringgit, that again reduces the cost of employment for the employer, which if you add it on, it will be about 750 to 800 ringgit, depending on which scheme you're looking at. So that is of great incentive for employees to take them in.
Now, the other thing that appeared in the budget also was the wage incentive given for Malaysians hired to replace foreign workers under the Locals at Work program. Yep. And this is giving people 350 ringgit to 500 ringgit a month. I suppose a lot of youths can apply for this, so this is relevant to you.
Yes.
Now, foreigners are the ones who are usually filling up the so-called 3D jobs, right? The dirty, difficult and dangerous jobs. Do you think that Malaysians would rush to queue up to sign up for this?
I believe that there are a number of Malaysians who have done that. For an example, I mean, you look at the recent report where there are more than 10,000 young Malaysians who are working in Australia illegally as fruit pickers. There are also hundreds of other Malaysians who travel to South Korea to work in the illegal industry because their pay is better. And in Malaysia, we've already had a success story, which is in Penang, right? Under Minister Guan Eng previously, what he did was a job was something like this, an income incentive plan, where he stopped all the foreign suppliers which these are the garbage disposal contracts previously given, and in the end subcontracted to all the foreigners. So he stopped all of that. So then he hired locals, but instead of just hiring locals, he also gave an income incentive. What happened after? Despite there's an increase in costs of employing them, but in the end, almost 100% of them were run by Malaysians. They were the ones doing the jobs. So what does that show? It just shows it is a problem of income. We need to reward them well and they will take up that job.
So but you want to push up the wages and remuneration up to the levels of, say, Australia or Singapore. And this might result in higher costs for the local companies, right? Because this has a time limit of 2 years. Yeah. And after that, companies as well as directly consumers would have to bear that higher inflation.
Obviously, you shouldn't just compare it directly with Singapore. Look at the income level of Malaysia. What's the average needed, right? So that's why in Malaysia, EPF has shown the difference in the cost of hiring a Malaysian and a foreigner is about 350 ringgit to 500 ringgit a month, depending on which sector. Plantation, more; service sector, less. So what government will do is that government will subsidize the disparity because
only for 2 years, though.
Yeah, for 2 years. And again,
after that, I mean, will this be complemented with foreign labor policy where you ban foreign labor?
Of course, we disallow a lot of foreigners into specific sectors in Malaysia. For example, there are calls to open up the barber segment, which I oppose because that's where a lot of young people, graduates of the vets, enter.
Okay, so from an economic viewpoint, this might lead to higher costs and inflation. How do you think policy should deal with this?
So again, a 350 ringgit to 500 ringgit increase a month, I believe will not lead to that great cost of inflation. And again, at the moment, our locals are at an unfairly disadvantaged. If you are a foreign worker, usually when you send your Malaysian money abroad, there's a multiplier effect. On top of that, you don't have to take care of a family here. You don't have to pay EPF. But as a local, you have to take care of all of that. At the same time, at the moment, without any incentive, you are paid not as a local, but as a foreign worker, and you are placed at a great disadvantage. The question is, how do you level the playing field and at the same time ensure that with adequate regulation and stamping of corruption, there will no longer be that great influx of foreign workers, which in the end caused Malaysian companies to be reliant on foreign workers. We obviously cannot punitively punish our local companies because we acknowledge the problems which they face, but there must be that balance. That's why we believe an income incentive proposal is one of the best way to leverage the problems within the system.
Syed Saddiq, Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister, is on The Breakfast Grill this morning, and we'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Good morning. We have Syed Saddiq, Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister, on the grill this morning. And Syed, we have a question here from the floor. Unemployment, low wages, high cost of living, etc. In spite of the government allowances in the latest budget, the incidence of mental health among millennials and Gen Zs are increasing with incidences of depression, anxiety and so on.
Yeah.
Do you have a plan to address this?
To me, this is also a very big youth issue. In Malaysia, studies have shown that one out of three Malaysians suffer from depression, and one out of five suffer from anxiety. It's something which is very big. We've heard many unfortunate cases where someone as young as 16 years old could commit suicide because of cyberbullying. So this is a big issue. The point is, we cannot work in silos. We need to coordinate together with different ministries. And that's why through the Ministry of Health, we're collaborating together to run the Youth Speak Out campaign, right, where we discuss and have a lot more meaningful dialogues across Malaysia, not just in urban centres, but also in suburban and rural areas to discuss about mental health so that the taboo can be taken down. Because at the moment, the biggest barrier is that this is a taboo, and those who discuss about mental health will automatically be labelled as those who should be sent to Tanjung Rambutan, which is a very big issue, especially in rural and suburban communities. And we need to fight and take out that taboo. The second part is to improve that social network or social support system. The Befrienders hotline now is subsidised and is free. Beyond that, we see we are training a lot more counsellors, even in schools, and also ones which are recognised by the Ministry of Health. I think about 900 clinics which also look into this to give specialised advice on how to deal with mental health. So it will be a step-by-step process. But I believe the Ministry of Health is doing a great job, but we need to work together because, again, the vast majority of those who are affected are indeed young people. And we need to collaborate together with Ministry of Health, Communications, Youth and Sports to ensure that mental health issue will be an issue of national priority. Just to briefly share as well, when I met up with my counterpart in Singapore, Minister Grace Fu, she mentioned that one of the biggest issues which even she's facing as a Minister of Youth in Singapore is on mental health. So this is an issue which not only affects Malaysia but across the world, but we need a coordinated effort to deal with it together.
And do you think that the increasing opportunities that are given by the gig economy can help alleviate some of these problems by giving youths some income for them to make ends meet?
So that depends which part of the gig economy, right? So for example, if it's about improving, if you look at ride-hailing, right? So if it's able to step up the person after, it's not supposed to be a permanent job, especially if the person has a degree. But if that's temporary until the person gets a full-time job, then it's great. But at the same time, we must also assist in whatever way possible for the person to transition. That's why the Graduates at Work program is critical, right? Because if, for example, you are a graduate, you have a degree, and then you're unemployed, you end up working for Grab, right? Mm-hmm. And you have a degree, and you should be able to utilize that degree. So if, even though you have worked for Grab, you are still considered to be unemployed in this scheme, so you are entitled for the Graduates at Work, which then will open up more jobs for you within the private sector and for you to get the income incentive for you to re-engage back into the formal economy. So I believe that while the gig economy is important, there must always be a transition plan for you to move forward, for you to skill up, and in the end get in a much better position. But beyond that, I think the trickle-down effect of the gig economy is very important. Don't just look at the jobs provided by the gig economy directly. Look at the indirect jobs. For example, if you look at Thailand, after Gojek and GrabFood entered, it wasn't just about the jobs created by the motorists, but the numbers of parcels distributed quadrupled in that 1 year time. That means e-commerce boomed to a great extent. And beyond that, even the small warungs and mamaks, because at the moment, a lot of the food deliveries don't go there because they don't have the economies of scale. But once you have more competition, and at the same time, there's a cross-subsidy scheme where they can also become a man-to-man distributor in the morning, then they can also go to the small warungs and mamaks, which then will multiply the profits of the small warungs and mamaks to become bigger. So I think that trickle-down effect is what matters the most. It's not just about the person who rides the motorbike or who drives the car. I think it's the multiplier and the trickle-down effect which improves the economy, which matters the most.
So you're really gung-ho in creating jobs for the youth, and a lot of time it's through policies, but sometimes you're seen as going directly intervening in the affairs of a private company. For example, in the Food Panda saga, where you said that consumers should take down arrogant corporations just as they can vote out elected representatives, and also arrogance is not the solution, only support corporations which are fair to workers and consumers. How do we draw the line between policy and meddling in business by the government and politicians?
So I think there are two parts here. Number one, there must be a balance, right? We need to ensure that there's enough space for the gig economy to flourish. At the same time, there must be adequate protection to safeguard the employees behind it. Because at the moment, they can be sacked at any point in time. In a three-day notice, their pay scheme can be changed radically to a point that it affects their livelihoods to a great extent. So they must be that balance. In California, there's a long debate. It entered the court and it was decided. In New York, through Uber and Lyft, it was decided. Even in Germany, the host country of Foodpanda, there are more regulations to ensure that in the end, that while the gig economy can survive, the employees' welfare is well taken care of. Mm-hmm. In Malaysia, we're just starting this debate, this discussion, and the regulations to come after. So there must be that balance.
So what can be done to safeguard the rights of these gig economy workers? I mean, you propose higher minimum wages. In fact, you want up to 1,500 ringgit per month in due course. Are you going to propose some kind of minimum hourly wage? Wage. For the gig economy?
Yeah, so I believe Minister Kulasegaran is looking into this. We've met up last week, myself, Minister Saifuddin Nasution and Minister Kula, to discuss about this. And he's already coming up with a paper to look into how do we best give room for the gig economy to flourish while taking care of employees' welfare. I think once that paper is ready, I believe he will present it to the public and therefore we can look on how to move forward. But I think we need to set the dialogue straight that as a minister, I can't just say, okay, I'm going to take your license. Those days are over. But at the same time, it's obviously my responsibility to also speak up for young people and to give advice where necessary to ensure that there is that balance, especially at the moment when there's a complete absence of the law. If we are not seen to do anything, the last thing which we want is for that vacuum to be exploited. And in the end, we are unfairly punishing the employees because of the lack of the framework. So temporarily, there must be an action while we wait for a long-term solution behind it.
And earlier on in what you said, you also expressed some worry that too many people are signing up for the gig economy and there is a danger that they will be left out of the higher value knowledge economy.
Yes.
What can be done about this?
So that's why I think the Graduates at Work program is spot on. So especially now when there are those who have diplomas and degrees who are still working within the gig economy, for example, as distributors of food or of people, then how do you want to reintegrate them back into the formal economy? How do we create quality jobs within the high supply chain? I think in the end, that's where, through the Graduates at Work, where they are given an income incentive of 500 ringgit and corporations are subsidised an additional 300 ringgit to create new jobs, these are the people who will be entitled to enter back into the formal economy, given a chance in the end with that degree to use that degree after 5 years of learning and finally putting it to good work. I think that's one of the ways to do so. Second is obviously to reskilling and upskilling. And that's why it's timely that there is an increase in the budget of TVET of 200 million ringgit and also beyond that, a 100 ringgit increase of allowance, which will then incentivize young people to enter into TVET course, to take up TVET courses and curriculum so that in the end, they become highly skilled, they get good jobs. So it's not just about giving jobs through the Graduate at Work program, the 6.2 billion job stimulus, is also about reskilling and upskilling them through TVET institutes like what Germany did. We can do it and we will continue to be doing this.
All right. Recently, you were also involved in a controversy about the retirement age, right? Extending that to 65 years old from 60 years old. And there's a question here from Ku. He's asking you why you oppose this, given that we have an aging society, whereas lifespans are lengthening, as well as people don't have enough to retire. And you were quoted as saying that the older people are hogging the jobs of the younger people. But this wouldn't be the case, right? It's not a mutually exclusive thing.
So I understand if we are like Japan at the moment. If we are like Japan, youth unemployment is at about 3.9%. In Malaysia, it's at 10.9%. And Japan has already reached the aging population. And at the same time, the birth rate is also greatly declining. Malaysia, we're about to reach that in 2030, but we're still not there. It's still far away. And even when previous changes in policies were made, it was done gradually. 1 year or 2 years increase, not a total 5 years increase. So the way in which we need to address this, not based on sentiment or emotions, but it's based on public policy. It's based on our...
But you're saying don't do one because it is at the expense of another. But that's not necessarily the case, right?
It is. Because the
older people can give some very different contribution with their experience, bringing something to the table from the youth.
It's true. But at the same time, it means that another job is taken away. So it is a zero-sum game. It is a zero-sum game here, especially looking at the current economic climate. Right? As I mentioned just now, if we are like Japan, where youth unemployment is very low, at the same time, they've already reached population decline and it's a highly aging society. In Malaysia, we'll reach that in 2030, but it's done gradually. So I think at the moment, we're not ready. We need to take time and we need to look at this from a public policy perspective. And that's the very reason why it's not just me saying it, but in a high cabinet meeting with the Prime Minister and the head of the civil service, both deciding that we should not increase it at the moment.
We have Youth and Sports Minister Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman on the Breakfast Grill this morning. And we will be extending this Breakfast Grill, so keep your questions and comments coming in. And we'll be back after this. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back and thanks for joining us on The Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng and today on The Breakfast Grill is Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister. And we have a few questions from the listeners and we hope we can do this in a quick fire round.
I'll try my best, yeah.
Okay, why is the government funding esports? 20 million ringgit was allocated to esports.
Because we believe that esports is a future industry. Last year, when the government invested 10 million in less than 24 hours, we got 30 million committed investment from the esports scene. We saw Razer investing an additional 100 million ringgit by opening up their very first HQ in Bangsa South, hiring more than 300 young people and paying them good jobs. So we believe the esports industry is not just about churning out esports athletes, but it's the ecosystem. Malaysia now is ranked 21st in the world in terms of esports revenue, a business of more than 500 million ringgit in Malaysia, creating high quality jobs in terms of giving developers, creators, and also athletes and ecosystem behind it. You know, when you stream, there's also a lot of money behind it. So I think this is a future industry which is worth investing in. We see SEA Games now giving 6 medals for esports, ASEAN Games as a form of demo sports, maybe soon even in the Olympics. It's worth preparing today.
There's an argument here that the youth is never serious about their jobs. Turnover is too high, always taking MCs, not showing up for work, too complacent, too comfortable relying on parents. Comments, please.
So I think this is the part which the Prime Minister keeps on stressing on. We cannot just provide jobs, but we also need to improve on diligence, on work ethics, and that needs to come in early from schools to universities, from TVET institutes. So we are doing that, for example, in the Ministry of Youth and Sports. Back then, they ran BTN, and BTN was known to be an indoctrination camp. We converted that to become the Malaysian Future Leader Schools, which train young people with good values, diligence, multiracialism, like what Japan did, mirroring the Japanese Future Leader School. In the end, I think once we build that great work ethics of diligence, I think we can move forward. So that's the first part. But second, not all young people are like that. There are a lot of young people who work tirelessly from morning to night, but in the end, easily get labelled as those who are lazy. I think this is just categorically false. You see young people now taking 2 or 3 odd jobs, doing it together, not being able to spend quality time with the family and get paid pittance. So I think it's unfair to categorise young people as those who do not take their job seriously. In reality, they love the country, they love their jobs, and we need to invest in them a lot more and to ensure that the work climate is better for them.
Now, what's happening with TVET and its policy? I mean, you have about 23 departments under the Youth Ministry for TVET, and about 6 billion ringgit has been allocated in the recent budget, throwing a lot of money at it. And yet, Malaysia's TVET contribution is only 6% compared to Germany's 60%.
You're right. And I think it will increase as time passes by, just to show how effective it is. So we have 22 TVET institutes under the ministry. And the rate of employment post-graduation is at an all-time high of 94 to 96%. If you are a graduate of a local university, it's about 80 to 90%. But TVET is much higher. The problem is the wage structure. Because if you're a graduate of university, you start about 2,500 ringgit and above. TVET, you start 1,500, 1,700 ringgit and above. It's about to scale up the TVET industry. You cannot just look at TVET for hospitality. You need to start going into a higher supply chain, like in Germany, right? Where they look at car manufacturing, aero manufacturing, which I believe is the future. That's why now, when there are billions of investments coming into Malaysia, FDI, into the aero manufacturing industry, which is bound to create 20,000 high-skilled TVET jobs for young people. So we need to fill that up. We need to ensure that TVET becomes a viable alternative and is no longer seen as a substandard, suboptimal education selection in contrast to universities. In Germany, from young, they already train their young ones that graduates of TVET and universities are of equal path not one of inferiority and superiority.
And so aero is one area that you mentioned, and it can't just all come from one sector, right?
No.
What do you think about the policies to improve the entire ecosystem of Malaysia to make it more geared to some of the latest developments, especially the IR 4.0?
You are right. So that's why it's important to automate. So one is the increase of 100 ringgit allowance, but that's not enough. You will get more people in and greater interest, but that's not enough. And that's why the 200 million increase in budget, which is to automate, right, which is to ensure that there are more teaching factories based in the vet institutes, is very important. So I show an example. We invested in a new machine in IKTB NPAGO. It's a 5-hex machine. And if you are trained to use the machine and you graduate with that unique skill set, your starting wage can go as high as 3,000 ringgit Malaysia. So the point is to always automate and to find new skill sets to ensure that even in typical manufacturing sector, that you find new tech to skill that TVET graduate with, so that in the end, you move up the supply chain.
Will the automation process kill off jobs as well?
So it will definitely kill off jobs, but as it kill off jobs, it create new jobs. Similarly, what internet did, what computerized did. The point is, we need to continue to move forward, because if we don't, in Malaysia, then we will be outcompeted by Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam, and many others. We need to be the frontliner.
All right. We have Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister, on the grill today. Let's talk about sports a little. It's great for national unity, and a sporting nation is also a healthy one. So we've seen sports greats like Nicole David, David and Lee Chong Wei retiring recently. But we also have the likes of Farah and Hardy, who's qualified to the Tokyo Olympics next year. Pandalela Rinong, Malaysia's diving queen. Julian Yee, gold medalist for figure skating, and many others. The list is quite long. But there's still a feeling that Malaysians want the nation to make a better splash internationally and regionally, hauling back more medals. What are the plans for this?
Number one, we need to improve the funding structure of sports. If you look, even in countries like Singapore, they fund to a great extent relative to their GDP. In Indonesia, you have cigarette companies, alcohol companies, gaming companies, all funding sports. In Malaysia, we no longer allow alcohol or cigarette companies to fund. At the same time, the profits of gaming companies has reduced to a great extent. So as a consequence, the funding of sports is getting smaller and smaller as there are a lot more sports coming up. And also the cost of investing in sports has increased.
How do you focus? There's so many
exactly,
sports.
You are
right?
Absolutely right.
And 617 million ringgit for the sports ministry, is that enough?
You think it's enough, but it's not. If you look in Japan, just one contribution from gaming company can already take up the total sports budget of Malaysia. The point is, you need to work well with the corporate sector. So if you look in the US, the money doesn't come from the government, it comes from the corporate sector. In Japan, it comes from the corporate sector as well. So in Malaysia, we need to ensure that the tech scheme becomes better so that corporate sectors are more likely to align and team up with us, especially in the youth development program. We have great companies like TNB, CIMB, all investing in youth development projects with the Ministry of Youth and Sports, but we need to scale that up a lot more. So while government invests, we also need to open up more rooms for partnerships so that in the end, this becomes a sustainable game. I just want to share one more thing which I feel very passionately about sports, which we are embarking on a major transformation next year, which is on women in sports. In 1972, in the United States, a congress lady from Hawaii proposed Title IX. Title IX ensured for there to be equitable funding between men and women in sports, that it must be fair spending. And there was a huge difference because, for example, previously it was only about 500 football players who were women in the United States, but by 1998, that number increased to about 171,000 women, but I think it's about a 17,000% increase.
How did they do that?
It's through Title IX. Mm-hmm. So with the institution of Title IX, it ensured that sports funding became more equitable, from them not having any women's sports team in basketball, football and futsal in schools or in universities. Now they had to have it. Before this, they never had sports scholarship for women. Now they have to have it. So in Malaysia, we are embarking on that journey next year. So that's why for the first time, we have a special carved out budget for women in sports, 10 million ringgit. Beyond that, we've also put in additional budget for women in sports in terms of rugby, football, futsal. We want for there to be equitable funding, because in the end, this is a new segment in Malaysia which is worth investing in. Because when you create icons at the top, that's when a lot more young women from school to universities play a lot more sports. I'm genuinely worried because when I see, especially in national schools, there are not enough women playing sports and taking sports seriously. And I think when we invest in this, this will not just create better women athletes, but at the same time, it will mean that a lot more women actively participate in physical activities and sports, which will improve Malaysia overall. It is a worth a journey to look at. We must do it immediately next year. So next year on sports, it will be a Women 2020 year.
This morning, we have Youth and Sports Minister Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman on the Breakfast Grill. And we're going to take a break now, but we'll be back after this. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. And on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Youth and Sports Minister Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman. Syed, we were talking about sports earlier, and we know that religion also rears its head.
Yep.
In the past, champion athletes were criticised for their attire, and we saw Terengganu recently proposing a draft code of conduct for Sharia-compliant sports attire. Is your ministry able to overrule such rulings?
Yes. And I think first part is to point out that I disagree with what was mentioned by the Terengganu state government. Immediately, I contacted MSN in Terengganu and got in touch with the office of the Exco. And he mentioned in the end that that's just a recommendation, but it hasn't been made a law. So I believe in the end, status quo prevails. What the athletes choose to wear is his or her right. In the end, what matters is that we are looking at a national hero or heroine who works tirelessly to represent Malaysia, who will work morning to night, non-stop, to win that gold medal, which will then inspire millions of other Malaysians. So in the end, let's give him or her the room to lead Malaysia forward without judging him or her of what he or she wears. So I think what's most important is for us to give full support to athletes. I think, for example, recently, when we see Farah Ann qualifying, again, the same line of criticism came in. Ah, she's un-Islamic. She's not dressed modestly. I mean, I asked these skeptics to really look at Farah Ann's contribution to the country and how much work she put in to make Malaysia amazing. I mean, you know how difficult it is to be a gymnast? You have to wake up ridiculously early. You have to go through immense diet. You can't eat all the great Malaysian food. On top of that, you know, you have to work up until nighttime, non-stop. You have to be super disciplined to be of that stature. And yet, what do we see? Or some people see, oh, she's wearing that. I mean, that is just ridiculous. So I think this is for us, a time for us to rally around her, to give support to our athletes. Because in the end, it's their contribution which made Malaysia great.
How do you square this with your position as youth chief of Bersatu, which upholds racial and religious rights, and sometimes you want to address the concerns of that crowd as well?
I think on this part, even Bersatu, we support our national heroes and heroines. Because I think in the end, this is not a political issue. It's just an issue of decency, of supporting our fellow Malaysians, especially those who make Malaysia proud. So that's where you see all of us coming together in support of our athletes. I think that's the part which matters the most.
And you know, Zaki Naik, he is not somebody who make a lot of Malaysians proud. And in the past, recently actually, you kind of flip-flopped on whether to deport Zaki Naik or not. I mean, your views of whether to deport him or not. Why that flip-flop?
I think there's no flip-flop. I still stand by my opinion. But as I mentioned, everything must be discussed, debated in cabinet. And in the end, for an example, when I met up with him, I think it's important for us to meet up with those who we disagree. And I mentioned to him specifically that he apologized, and I think we need to move forward. The reason why I say that is because there are so many important policy issues which are being debated, which are being articulated, but yet in the end, we keep on being dragged back by issues of race and religion nonstop, to the point that critical public policy issues on job creation, on the living wage, on cost of living, all gets put to the issue of second priority. And I believe that is exactly what parties like UMNO and PAS want, is for us to be dragged down on the debates and dialogues on race and religion nonstop. But personally, I believe we need to move forward. I think now this case is being taken up by the police.
This is at a very fundamental level of the nation's development, right? Racial harmony.
Yeah.
And Zaki Naik is, and all he represents is opposite of that. And recently also, the Prime Minister and Bersatu's chairman attended the Malay Dignity Congress, in which resolutions were also passed along, obviously, very racial lines. Does this seem at odds with the spirit of a shared prosperity
Malaysia
vision?
Malaysia will always be for all Malaysians. I think that must be very clear. And that's why I still stand by the line that it belongs to all Malaysians and we should never, ever call our Chinese and Indian brothers or Ibans and Kadazans as pendatang. That is just uncalled for and it's treacherous to Malaysian unity. But at the same time, I believe it's important to give room for the police to investigate and for action to be taken up by the Attorney General. I think we need to go through the independent channel, specifically commenting on the Congress Maruah, which happened recently. I think it's important to listen to Tun M's speech. What happened before does not in any way represent the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister in his speech, and he's not telling something new. I think I've already memorized his speech because literally the night before when he was addressing the guys from Pemuda Harapan, it was the exact same speech, same example, same references where he keeps on stressing that Malays cannot keep on blaming Chinese and Indian for their backwardness. We need to look into ourselves. We need to improve ourselves. We need to improve our moral ethics, our work ethics. We need to work 10 times harder and we must stop blaming others for what is to happen in Malaysia. I think that message must be mentioned to the Malay community. I think it's not wrong for a leader like Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir to signal towards the Malay community that in order for us to move forward, we should stop deflecting blame. I mean, if he can't do that, then who else will do that to target and reach the hearts and minds of the Malay community? I think that message is what matters, not the ones mentioned before, which even I also disagree with many, many of the things mentioned before.
And earlier on, before we went on air, you told a very interesting story about how you and your mentor, Dr. Mahathir, met. It was during a time when he was still in UMNO.
Yeah.
And at that time, you were very critical about UMNO.
Yes.
And it so happens that history has dictated that, you know, Dr. Mahathir right now is out of UMNO. Do you think that Bersatu is different from UMNO today and in what ways?
I think it's vastly different. The first and the major difference is that it's run by those who are not greedy for power because those who started up Bersatu are those who lost power, lost money, lost positions and had nothing but were sincere enough to join the struggle to liberate Malaysia. That was the first. So therefore, even the ethics of the formation of Bersatu and the history was clear. That is the first part. Second, even within the party structure, there are critical changes which make us different for UMNO. For example, it's more friendly to women. They must be a woman vice president, therefore increasing the power of women in Bersatu. The youth chief is also of equivalent stature to the vice president. And that's where, for example, you see many, many young people being fielded as candidates in the last election. More than 20 young persons fielded as candidate. And beyond that, we are in important committees. We form policies for the parties, for the party. And we also define the future of the party. There are term limits put in the party. The politics of patronage is not as strong as what is in UMNO. It's actually much, much, much smaller. All parties have it, but this is much smaller. So in terms of culture, in terms of the history, it's very much different. While it's still seen to be a race-based party, but let's not forget, we are in a multiracial coalition and we're a lot more coalition-driven than UMNO, which can force their beliefs to all parties. And in the end, there's a great power imbalance. But within the Harapan coalition, it's a lot more fair. Yes, it'll become obviously noisier, but that's the beauty of a diverse democracy.
And so why not just merge with PKR, right? Because they are also going for a multiracial policy in terms of the relationship among races.
I think this is the part which Tun Dr. Mahathir mentions many, many times. Malays, especially in the rural side and suburban Malaysia, still demand for there to be parties like Bersatu. The question is, you must still be within that a multiracial coalition, and at the same time, you must stand firm in defending the federal constitution, the Rukun Negara, which formed the bedrock of a multiracial Malaysia. For example, there are still a vast majority of Malays who are still relatively poor, and there must be targeted policies to help them, not just based on race alone, but public policy, formulated policies which will back it up to support them. That's where you need institutions like MARA, you need institutions like FELDA and FELCRA to in the end alleviate millions of Malays who were in poverty before to be in a better position. So I think in the end, the way in which we move forward, there must be a party like Bersatu within that Harapan coalition, which in the end will define the right equitable future for Malaysia. Kesaksamaan bersama or shared prosperity is all about equitable distribution of wealth. And this is what is needed in Malaysia.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And that was Syed Abdul Rahman, Youth and Sports Minister, on this morning's Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.